Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening.
Hey everybody, this is the Brothers Wiss number 64. Coming at you is Greg Sowell from Texas. Right above me in the frame is Andrew Cox, all the way from Australia. What time is it over there?
Just on 10 o'clock in the morning.
And you just woke up?
Yeah.
You're a ridiculous person. All right.
It's a Sunday.
Up into the top left, you've got Justin Wilson from Indy. Say the words, Justin.
Howdy, howdy.
There you go. Now they know who you are. And then also top right, you got Mike Hammack. What's up, Mikey?
How's it going? Not too bad. I've just been, past couple minutes, I've just been looking through our previous posts. To actually get a definitive when was the last time we had Wilson and Cox on at the same time. And I'm about on it, but I think it was back in 2013. It was June of 2013.
All right, that was the early days.
Just ships passing in the night.
I think we've actually seen each other since then in person.
Yeah. Good deal, good deal. All right, let me start this off on a different note. So how have you guys been sleeping lately? Been doing pretty good?
August 22nd, 2013.
All right, there you go. Because
I've
go ahead.
I've been sleeping pretty good since I've lost 42 pounds.
Killer, man. Dude, that's awesome. I think Miller was saying that he's been doing better too. But if you're looking for a deeper sleep, how about a mattress that has better alignment and relentlessly designed? If so, you should look no further than Sonar.software. They're scalable, intuitive, comprehensive ISP billing and operational support system. Be sure to hit them at Sonar.software. No, I've actually did a little bit more work with Sonar this week. I did a migration for a customer over to Carrier Grade NAT. So went into the IPAM, added the pools, went into the DHCP server, assigned the pools. Whole process took about 15-20 minutes. It was pretty painless, pretty seamless, especially since I had never touched that portion of Sonar. So I'm liking it so far. I seem to be getting more and more work associated with it, so that's a good thing. So
me as a customer of Sonar for a few months now, since they bought WispMon, sounds like you have more Sonar experience than I do.
So far, I mean, I haven't started from scratch. It's already been pre-existing systems, so that always makes it a little bit easier, you know, if you can kind of look at the examples and go from there. That's also predicated on the fact that the person before you did it all right. So far, I like it. It's been pretty easy to work with.
How are you liking their carrier grade NAT implementation?
Seems normal to me. I don't see anything too wackadoo with it. A lot of it is the carrier grade NAT I did this week. I lined up a whole lot of dominoes, got it all the implementation ready, and then told the customer, all right, whenever you're ready to flip the switch, change this pool and this pool. And then I had assumed, you know, it'd be like a day or two, or, you know, they'd want to do it at 1 a.m. Not that it matters. And then 5 minutes later, he said, okay, I flipped it. I was like, oh, okay, well, all right, rock and roll. We're going. We're pulling clients. No. I mean, it makes sense. Like on a wireless network, usually early in the morning, I guess, is probably a pretty safe bet because, you know, at 9 o'clock, most people are at work or still asleep, you know, if they're students or whatever. So it's kind of a safe time to do it.
Are they doing port rules on the edge, or how are they just doing you know, 100.64 rules, or are they actually doing stuff with you know, here's a certain port range for these IPs, or are they just doing a strict, you know, 100.64 NAT?
Well, it was kind of a sticky situation. We had some, it was like a /22 from an existing network that wasn't owned by them, and so they had a very limited time frame to get off of that addressing. So from their upstream provider, because it wasn't even their upstream provider's addressing, so from them, we were able to get like a /28 out of them. So just carved off a few for Okay, so this 164.0.0, that gets one IP address they're going to masquerade over to, and then the next one gets another IP. And so just trying to line all that. I mean, when you've only got 3 or 4 days to work with, you just sort of just bang
it out. So you
aren't
doing any, you know, hey, ports, you know, 20,000 to 25,000 go to, you know, these addresses, 25,000 to 30. You weren't doing anything fancy like that.
No, nothing fancy. No, okay. We really just did this block of addresses. Is going to pat to this one public IP and then the next and the next, just to keep it kind of simple for now. There's going to be a little bit more addressing in the near future as well as IPv6, but for now it all, I mean, it went smooth. All the accounting's working. It's doing what it's supposed to, so I was happy to see it.
Cool.
All right, so somebody had mentioned also previously that we needed an intro to our YouTube videos. I keep forgetting people actually watch that stuff. So it does make sense. Mike said, or somebody said, hey, let's ask the audience if somebody wants to make one for us. That would be cool. You guys go for it. I found some on Fiverr that weren't too terrible. So if nobody has any ideas, nobody wants to proffer anything up, then we'll just swing some Fiverr stuff. But putting it out there, hit us up if you guys have the video skills. I certainly don't. All right. So something Mike and I had sort of went back and forth about and talked about was Slack highlights. So we have a Slack channel just for patrons, and there's a lot of good discourse going back and forth and a lot of good questions to ask. And we were thinking, why not, you know, every podcast, we just highlight a couple of the good ones that came out of there. And I'm gonna put people on blast. I'm gonna say their names. Hopefully they don't mind too much. So Ryan McAfee had asked about a simple firewall script, and of course Thomas, Johnny on the spot, was happy to accommodate with, I don't know, it was like 20 lines that do a pretty decent job of securing, you know, a very basic one. Steve Gilbert was talking about how he's been testing the new MikroTik TLS host feature. It doesn't appear to still be working in his implementations yet. I think he said some oddities with NATing. Ryan McAfee again was talking about his Cisco Fabric extenders, the FEX 2248. If you guys aren't familiar, which you may not be, the Nexus line, you can get this thing called a Fabric extender. It's like a switch without a lot of intelligence, and it has the hard cable back to the Nexus. And he was talking about how every time he does an upgrade, those things sort of disappear off the face of the earth. So exercise caution there. I thought that was interesting. And then I think the particularly good highlight is Greg Soule at 1242 said, again, I hope you nip it in the bud soon. Mike Hammett replied, hee hee, nip. So there you go. Really good highlights and commentary.
Everyone's kicked a goal.
Thanks, Mike. But no, but there's been a lot. I mean, people have been really active. Jeremy, new guy on there. Jeremy. It's not like he hasn't washed his hands. He's not Jeremy. He's Jeremy. He's been pretty active. A lot of good stuff from him. Mike Rohn? Is that his name? Michael Rohn?
Yeah.
He's been pretty active in there. A lot of really good stuff. So if you guys want to join the Slack, join in on the discourse. It's patreon.com/thebrotherswist. Jump in there and support us if you guys would. That knowledge pool is just getting bigger and bigger. A lot of really good people in there. Let's see. Mike posted up something about in MikroTik 6.42 RC28, they added Virtuo SCSI driver on KVM installations. And Mike was curious what the, you know, what the draw or drive of that is. And Andrew Thrift was happy to accommodate by saying that his CHRs in some instances, whenever they're migrating between virtual hosts, would crap on themselves. And he saw through other systems that using the maybe it's VirtIO, I don't know how you say that, SCSI driver, actually, what does he say, it issues like a pause on the SCSI bus to the guest OS, so it doesn't brick as hard. So he's looking forward to that addition to, I guess, 642 once they actually complete it.
Yeah, 642's had a lot of CHR additions that have been welcome. You know, one of them was that one of the versions added OpenVM tools, which is amazing. Like, you know, they didn't understand for the longest time why you would possibly want that. You know, if you want to turn it on or turn it off or reset it, just use ACPI is good enough. Of course, I could be confusing MicroTik with the OpenBSD guys. And I didn't mean it just to piss off Tom, but I could actually be genuinely confusing the two right there.
It doesn't matter. Tom's not going to listen to this.
So that's important because that provides the gateway to help manage some of those, you know, live migrations and whatnot. You know, make them a little more smoother, and it's nice to see them in there now.
Yeah. I seem to be doing more and more with the CHRs. How about you guys?
Yeah, I've got one of my clients. They've got one CHR running now as a provider edge. I'll be adding a second one here probably next week or two, and I kind of kicked off the process to migrate off of a Viata firewall. I'll probably spin up two more CHRs just for that, because my plan is to have, you know, two provider edge routers going then to two CHRs that are just passive firewalls. That way the people that do the BGP configs don't mess up the, you know, firewalling and vice versa. Because at some point it won't be just me, it'll be the other people in there. So then I know who to yell at for breaking things. It's working really good. Oh yeah, OpenVM tools also, it will allow, like, if you force a shutdown, and VMware will naturally migrate everything off to another host in the cluster. Not so if you don't have OpenVM tools.
Nice. I know, Andrew, you're a big user of CHRs. Or I don't know if you have a whole lot of them, but you really rely on them, right?
So we've got at least one with each of the Bright Wi-Fi regions. We use it for the VPN sessions to all of our devices. So that's sort of a mix of OVPN and SSTP, depending on what the customer prefers. But they've been really good. We've had sort of a few versions that have had some weird issues. One recent one we had, we'd sort of see packet loss after about 3 to 4 hours of runtime. But using them as sort of core infrastructure routing and things in Microsoft Azure, Amazon AWS, like it just makes it really easy to get a router in there that we're familiar with. It's easy to do the things we want to do. So it's good.
Yeah. I'm using one in AWS for a customer, and so far it's working really well. And they're going to end up using it for tunneling. So out at the customer site, they have a custom application that really has the phone back home. And it's also kind of an administrative interface for them, so they can do monitoring through this thing and all that stuff. So it's going to create secure tunnels out to AWS, and it's been working a treat so far for what we've been using it. So do you guys feel like at some point you're going to quit deploying like CCRs and just do VM hosts at the edge of really big networks and run a CHR on that? Like, do you foresee yourself doing that, or is it, I mean, do you still prefer to have kind of a physical network appliance at the edge?
For me at the edge, well, I'm already doing it for one of my clients.
Yeah,
pull it all up. I yanked out a Juniper and I'm putting in some CHRs.
I think for me the biggest problem is finding the boxes that can be modular with interfaces. I mean, yeah, for me the hang up is I don't want to be dependent on, you know, the same couple of interfaces in and out. You know, I want physical interfaces for redundancy. So I want ports. I don't want the same port in and out for different VLANs. I don't want to virtualize my ports. I want, you know, if I have 16 connections, I want at least 16 connections.
Fair enough.
I think Hot Lava, they've got 6 port 10 gig cards. And then I believe they have 3-port 40 gig cards, which you put on the fan outs, you know, in a 4-to-1, you get 12 10 gig ports per slot. You know, so you could really stack those up. Tom's a big hot lava guy.
Yeah, and that's, you know, then you kind of lose some of the, yeah, you can do the cool things with the virtualization, but then you're losing some of the, if you look at a from a purely cost benefit, then you're saying, okay, am I gaining anything cost wise with virtualization? Sure, you're gaining all the, you know, the kind of cool failover with virtualization, and you know, you can go back and forth all day long with, okay, if I'm doing virtualization, I don't need as much hardware, so I'm saving power, I'm saving this and that. But you know, at what point do you go down the red pill or the blue pill? So right now for me, it's a, you know, which pill do you swallow? There's no, if the hot lava cards were markedly different as far as buying CHRs, then that would be the deciding factor. Right now, a hot lava card to get as many ports that are in a CHR is almost as much as just buying the CHR.
Yeah. You mean CCR?
Yeah, CCR, yeah.
Something that's hit me before is, you know, when you're looking at reliability, what's more reliable, say a virtualized infrastructure or a physical network appliance? Because, most of your server infrastructure now is going to have a DRAC. It's going to have some kind of out-of-band management, right? Some IPMI, integrated lights out or whatever. I mean, everybody calls it something different. But if, you know, your router is what's hosted on there, that's your gateway. So if you need to get to that router to backdoor into the out-of-band management and the server itself is what's having a problem, then you can't get to any of that infrastructure. I guess if you have like a small device for your out-of-band management, that would make more sense. But I don't know. It sort of feels like putting all of your eggs in one basket, you know? And if you separate the two, maybe you'll get a little lucky and can still get to the router.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think at some point you got to figure out how much redundancy do I actually want to build into a network. And I don't know. I haven't taken the leap to just go pure virtualized at the edge in everybody's network where they didn't have additional redundancy.
I was going to say it's not just about that redundancy in the virtualized network as well. It's if you build up a network around a virtualized router, virtualized appliances and things that are running all of your network, then the moving parts inside those bare metal boxes that you're running, there's sort of 3 or 4 different layers you've got to stack together to build that. So if something goes horribly wrong, you're not looking at just grabbing another router out of the box, dropping the same configuration on and putting it in a rack. It's you've got to put ESXi or something on it, then you've got to load the CHR, then you've got to load your other machines and make sure you've rebuilt the network configuration. And like even when I'm looking at virtualized infrastructure, I'm always trying to consolidate the number of interfaces I have to sort of just have, here's your primary, here's your backup, and be they 1 gig, 10 gig or 40 gig interfaces, then trunk that into a physical switch that you can pull all your customers in on. Like it's if I needed to, I could replace that virtual machine with a regular hardware router very quickly, whereas I couldn't go around the other way.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think people definitely need to consider that cost when they're building something. If you can afford to have multiple of those things set up, ready to go, failover in place, that's great. It probably will save you a lot of money, but it's also it's not a bitch to set up. Like it's just harder. You need a lot more knowledge to get to that point.
Yeah, so. And I mean that's a really great point. There's a lot more layers of abstraction, right? So MikroTik focuses I think they probably look at the CCR line as one of the main focus points when they're testing new versions, right? And so they thoroughly test that, right? So imagine you have a CHR running in VMware, right? So that's running on the hypervisor. Well, now you're going to upgrade from, say, VMware 6 to Or say you're 5 and you're going to 6.5. What are the odds that something might go wrong in that upgrade process, right? There's a lot of layers of abstraction. And so I totally get what you're saying there, that you, I mean, it's, you know, how much, I guess, how much testing can they really do? And, you know, I think, you know, it's sort of an ecosystem that's outside of their control. So,
Look, if you've got a virtualized router though, like, don't get me wrong, it would definitely make it easier. If you've got your testing suite and everything, your MikroTik, it would definitely make it easier to test a virtualized router than it would be a physical one. Like, you can actually go through and test every little thing because you could do that programmatically. But just in the end of the day, like, the physical device being there, you can pull 3 or 4 of them out of boxes and you know that the performance on them is going to be the same. You don't have to build anything to get there. It's ready to go. So, whereas, yeah, your VMware stuff is it running on the same hardware on both sides? Is there some sort of SAN problem where you're connecting the disks to the storage over here and this one has an issue, or your SAN crashes and then you've got sort of 5 or 6 things to look at? So that's my sort of 2 cents on it. I'll always try and simplify it, keep it easy. If there's a genuine substantial cost saving to be made, then it's worthwhile looking into it and saying, well, what is our recovery time here? What is the actual ongoing cost to us to maintain this? And is it worthwhile that pricing discount? So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let me look at it from a data center perspective too. We see, you know, so in a data center environment, you have smart hands and eyes, right? Which are guys sitting in a NOC somewhere, network operations center. You call them, you email them, they'll go and they'll push buttons, they'll reboot things, they'll do whatever, right? So what do we get more calls on than anything else? I think genuinely there's more server infrastructure, so it's probably going to be more people saying, hey, go poke this server, go throw a console on this thing. But we do see a decent bit of people, you know, having to physically touch network infrastructure, you know, to reboot it. So say you do have a redundant device in there, it completely tanks, you need to move down, you have to have smart hands and eyes go in there and physically move connections. Whereas if you were doing that with a virtualized infrastructure that's redundant, and a primary fails, well, ultimately your internet connections and things, those are going to go into a switch, right? That's then going to feed into your virtual infrastructure. So if that switch goes bad, you still have to have somebody physically go touch it to move the connects, you know, the cross connects as well. I guess it's, you know, 6 or 1/2 dozen, you know, it ends up being the same thing one way or the other. You can't control all this stuff is man-made, right? So at some point it's going to fail. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's virtual or physical piece of hardware. So I don't know.
At my client, I'm doing all these migrations for, I'm landing their different transit/transport circuits on different switches. My physical VMware hosts have, you know, multi-port 10 gig NICs plugging into each of the switches. So then each virtual router on each host can talk to everything. But yet there's, you know, hardware separation, you know, there's separate switches, separate servers. You know, so obviously if they lose a switch, they lose whatever upstream is on that switch, but then the other upstream is on the other switch that goes out the other port on the server.
So you get some redundancy there. So something else, and I don't want to name names because sometimes people don't like you know, calling them out for this stuff, but they were talking about how they run, and I'm sure there's a specialized name, it's like the Fortinet virtualized firewalls. They run those in kind of a virtualized infrastructure, and they have all of their client connections kind of pull back in from all of the remote offices and hit one device to go out to the internet. And so they gain a lot of economies of scale there, right? So instead of having physical firewalls at all these places, they can have all those policies applied in one location. And so supposedly they save a lot of money in that way. And so I think that's, that's another really good use case for virtualized network infrastructure that I think most people haven't really thought about, although it's not always practical. So like here in the US, getting transport's fairly expensive, but I know in some of those other countries, some of the more civilized ones like Andrew's, where they have kind of the national broadband system where you guys can you can get tails pretty inexpensively, right? Like transport tails.
If they've built it yet.
If you're talking sort of like third parties and things, then yes, it's NBN is a big where do I even start? It's like you're talking tail costs that vary depending on the speed that you're buying, but then you're also having to pay their CVC cost, which is like you pay the tail cost, you pay your port fees, and then you pay your actual amount of bandwidth you want to pull out of the NBN network. So, and they've actually broken that up into 151 locations around the country. So you have to buy bandwidth at each of those locations. Hmm. So if you want to serve 200 meg customers, you have to buy 100 meg of CVC at, I think the current rate is about $7 per meg.
Oof.
So, and that's just layer two access to your customers. So,
well, I don't know. In some places here in the US, that's a pretty decent price. In others, it's not so much.
Yeah. Like it's a great idea, but until they decide to write this off, they've still got these huge costs. It's something like one of the guys over here worked it out and said it's like three times more to get bandwidth from a POI to an end customer than it is to get the same bandwidth over to the United States. So
really,
that's when you're buying at scale.
Wow, that's, I mean, because I know that like I never thought about cost of bandwidth to other places. It just cost of bandwidth is, you know, now it can be as cheap as, you know, 10, 15 cents a meg in the US for just the whole internet. And then, you know, as I talk to, you know, more of you guys in Australia and New Zealand and find out that, you know, you have a national bandwidth cost and then an international bandwidth cost, and the international bandwidth cost is, you know, astronomically more expensive. And I'm I never even thought of that.
If I went to someone as just a regular business or something, and I was like, oh, I have some gear in the data center, I want to actually set up my own transit and everything, and announce my own blocks of IPs, then straight off the bat, if I was looking for 100 meg, most people would probably say sort of $10 to $15 per meg. If I'm dealing with sort of blended transit or something, then it might come down to sort of $8 or so. But you really need some volume to be pulling that price down at the moment.
Hmm.
Yeah, so then these tails cost more than that.
Yeah, so that's the really silly thing. They've built this whole NBN network as a revenue generation item, which was never going to work.
Hmm.
And because they need it to generate revenue, they've got the prices so high. So why would ISPs do anything other than buy the absolute minimum that they can get away with? We had something come up through the ACMA recently, which is the Australian Communications and Media Authority, who do a lot of the a lot of the stuff for like wireless communications, internet networks, like who all the licensed carriers and everything are, and then are requiring ISPs to not only list what your maximum speed is, but what your expected peak time speed is. So all of our ISPs here pretty much overnight are now have gone from saying you've got a 25 meg plan, a 50 meg plan, a 100 meg plan, to you've got a 100 meg plan and you'll get about 40 meg in peak times, or you'll get about 30 meg in peak times, depending on who they are and how contended their network is.
Okay. Hmm. That's interesting. So they've, because, you know, I mean, here in the States, we definitely make those claims. You know, they'll sell it as gigabit internet service with an asterisk. You know, and yeah, it's once you dig way down in that fine print, yeah, it's up to, and to be honest, like in most of my markets, when you're getting a gig, you're gonna at peak get about, I don't know, 350, something like that, you know. So it's a third of what's advertised, which is insane that that's okay for people to do. And then it's tricky because I'm sure a lot of other people have run into this. You know, you want to advertise what's truly there. So you'll say, all right, you're getting a 10 meg connection. And people don't understand that's a symmetric 10 meg. I'm guaranteeing you this. It's not oversubscribed. You're always going to get it. But when the next guy is saying, I'm going to give you 100, and say, even if it's equivalent, I mean, you're going to go for that 100 every time. It's I don't know. It's tricky. What are you going to do? You either play the game with them or you just try and do something else, I guess. People are always going to run into that. That's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah, it's kind of a weird black hole you guys deal with over there. I've started talking to some guys over in Perth, and they might as well be in a completely different country from you because they're on the west side of the island. Not that you guys are an island. You're enormous.
And what's always surprised me about that is I haven't found any maps of terrestrial fiber from east to west, but lots of companies build across the bottom of the country out in the ocean to get from east to west. And I'm like, I mean, there's roads. I see them on the map. There's roads. Why don't they just go down the road? But
there are some there. But yeah, once again, like it's all of them go around the bottom rather than across. Like it's much more efficient to go around. But yeah, same thing. There's for people that are providing services in Perth, it makes sense to buy your transit passing out one of the fiber services that comes into Perth. Rather than hauling it all the way back across to Sydney and going out from there.
So. How much of your traffic would you say is international anyway? I'm assuming most of your stuff is going to be, you know, like the same stuff ours is, like Netflix and YouTube and stuff. And you guys have caches locally there, right?
Yeah. So it depends on the company and what your traffic profile looks like. I would say between 60 to 70% of ours at the moment is national versus international. The other thing you have to keep in mind as well is there's the big players here, the Telstras, the Optuses, and now more so TPG, who don't like to peer with other providers. Telstra is the worst for it. If you want access to their network, you have to buy it.
Of course.
So it's that international component that you normally talk about ends up including Telstra and Optus because you don't find them in peering exchanges. They want everyone to pay for access to their network. And I think it was Cloudflare a few years ago who did a big post on the cost of providing bandwidth in Australia. And the biggest part was having to pay these monoliths, these huge ISPs over here who just don't want to play nice with anyone. So.
But then again, what's their motivation to play nice? If it's working for them, why should they care?
Yeah,
they can.
They have the
they can charge for it, so they do.
Yeah. I mean, you're going to, you know, if somebody's you know, making it rain, why would you ever do anything to change that? What's a little bad PR, you know, when you're making money hand over fist, you know? I could say if I was making millions of dollars a year, and people were just saying I wasn't a nice guy, I think I'd be all right with that. Yeah. He's kind of a jerk.
You go outside and you start the key to your Ferrari and you drive home and you hop in your heated pool and it doesn't matter.
I don't know. I like to talk big. But still, right? At some point, it would be so much money that I could probably get over that. you know, I could get over the feeling. But I could hire enough people to be around me to tell me what a nice guy I am that it would be all right.
Yep.
I could pay somebody to write like a Chrome plugin that would get rid of all of the bad media attention when I was browsing around.
Hire some, you know, third world country to sit there on their banks of iPhones to do away with the comments.
There you go. I don't know. I mean, I get it, and I think it's logical. I don't know. For me, at least, I like to understand why things happen. It doesn't necessarily make it any better, but if I can understand it, it's. You know, I don't know. It's okay at that point, I guess. A big company is going to be a big company. That's what they do. That's why they exist, to make money. They're not here to make friends. That's what I've heard. They're not here to make friends. We're here to make money. So there you go.
I guess going further down the rabbit hole. So then with, you know, Telstra and Optus and whatnot, for you to to get to their network without buying it, is your traffic going to the States, or is it going to like Singapore, Hong Kong, Tokyo?
No, generally the sort of I guess what you call the tier one carriers here will be connected to them. It's sort of I guess we have a different representation of what they are here. It's generally the tier one is ones that are buying either like direct Telstra and direct international connectivity. So every like they can peer away all their other stuff if they want, but they're dealing direct, whereas as sort of a tier two or a tier three, you're buying from the likes of AAPT, Vocus, Superloop, those ones that have their own arrangements to get international access. So when you're going through one of those, you're getting access to Telstra locally anyway. It's still cheaper for them to buy it locally than try and send it back through through whoever in the US.
Okay. And from what I understand, your Megaport exchanges are really strong over there, right? So you've got most of the handset providers on there.
Yeah. So this is where they all started. So we've got Megaport pretty much all the major locations here, and that means that having access to a Megaport, I can get any transit provider I want. Really, I can reach out to someone and say, hey, do you want to provide us this transit? This cost, and it's just the cost of the Megaport service to get it to me. So I'm not sort of limited in who I deal with. I don't have to be in the same data center as them anymore, which is great.
Very nice. Very nice. All right.
I guess enough of the rabbit holes.
Yeah. All right. So something else that popped up is the European Mom is coming up pretty soon. For everybody listening that's over in Europe, which I don't know how many of the people that is, be sure to pop over and say hi to Thomas. He's going to be working the Unimus booth, unimus.net, your backup software. But also, this is a great time for speculation and open it up. I'm just curious what people think is going to happen out there, what's going to be announced network-wise, like equipment, I guess, or maybe software-wise. I'm really I don't think version 7 is going to get announced. I don't think there's going to be an early beta or anything. Great. I mean, it's still going to come up. And I know Giannis is going to shake his head because he knows he's listening right now. And he's like, Greg, I can't do my Giannis. I haven't heard Giannis in long enough. I can't do a proper. It'll just come out sounding like Drago from Rocky IV, and that's not what Giannis sounds like. But yeah. So what? I'm not gonna hold my breath for version 7. Equipment wise, you think? I mean, what do you guys think?
On the 7 thing, I actually thought that 7 would be there this year, until I saw, at one point early last year, they were, just had this one thing to straighten out, and it was going to be ready. And then I was like, okay, well, they usually do their big announcements in Europe, so European Mom next year it'll be. And then like a couple of weeks ago, I saw, some comment like, when we finish the routing engine for the next major routing engine, I'm like, wait, so you're not done with it yet? I was hoping you were going to have at least a, public beta or something like that available, which, still another year or two for it to, get all those bugs ironed out. But no, apparently they're not even done with that yet. So
I think we'll see more Switch hardware now that 641 has moved to the new Switch stuff. I think we'll see more Switch hardware. We'll see more Switch fanciness. We'll start seeing more features that we can do with Switch chips. They'll concentrate on that for a little bit. That'll keep their attention for a little bit.
Yeah, the 300 series, there's still a lot in those chipsets that they haven't unlocked.
Yeah.
So you could see a lot of that.
Maybe they'll actually have all of the hardware that they announced at the last European Mom.
I'm still waiting for those 24-port PoE switches.
That and the long range 60 gigahertz stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's still sort of.
I've been using a few of those now. The 60 gigahertz links have been really good. It's nice not having to sort of step someone through, like a little to the left, a little to the right. Like,
the beamforming's pretty good.
Works, yeah, the beamforming stuff works really well.
I heard from a fairly reliable source. They said keep trying the new release candidates on your WAP 60s because they're adding new features. Like every RC, they're putting new enhancements, improvements in.
Yeah.
So.
And I guess to kind of merge this topic with an earlier topic, you know, before you mentioned about, you know, going, you know, CCR or virtual for the edge, but then, you know, talk about their new hardware and, you know, opening up the software features on how they already have announced, you know, released, you know, kind of now like the go-to power router for a tower would be like a CCR, like 1009 or 16 or something like that. Because you're needing the CPU to process all of that, you know, including all your backhauls and whatnot. But what I'm waiting for is for one of those CRS 300 series to have the full, you know, chipset forwarding, of the MPLS and all that. 'Cause then they'll do it at line rate. So then you have, say, like, I first got this idea from Justin's networks. You know, your access point router does your triple PoE and firewalling and all those queues and things. And then he had another router that did all the backhauls. Well, in this case, I'd have one of those CRS 300s, you know, $100, $200, you know, I don't know what they're going to cost. But then they'll do my backhaul, you know, MPLS forwarding at line rate. Yeah. It'll be on the you know, access point router to then, you know, add and drop those labels. But if I can spend $100-$200 on a router that'll move all my backhauls at line rate, you know, that's what I'll move to.
You know,
and then you can have like two or three of them as well.
Yeah. Well, you know what this kind of reminds me of? It's sort of funny is that you know, back in the day, Cisco process routed everything, right? Their packet forwarding or packet switching, I guess is what they called it. You know, and then they went to kind of net flow or route caching where it would switch once or it would go through the proc once and then it would just follow that flow for everything else in that subsequent, right? And you got improvements. And then you went with Cisco Ceph, right? The ASICs. I'm just talking about Cisco because they, you know, they were the first to stuff. I'm not saying they did it the best or they are the best, but they were one of the first to get to it. Anyway, what's one thing you ran into a lot, like say with like the early switch models, was there's a lot of oversubscription. And then say the way you would do QoS would be different from switch to switch because they would use different ASICs. So different ASICs built in would have different buffers. So even then they would sort of sometimes have parity across like all the switching line. Like they would try and make commands work, but they couldn't because the physical hardware was different, right? And so it had very distinct limitations. And so then MikroTik came along and it blew my mind because they're doing everything in software, which means the only limitation you have is how much CPU power you have. You know, if you want an entirely new feature, you just write it in software, right? No longer are we constrained by these hardware implementations, you know, the buffers associated with things. I know we are still to some degree, but not the way we used to be. And now here we are reversing course and going back to these hardware implementations, you know, where it actually, some of the routing functionality, like the MPLS is built into hardware, you know, so it's going back to where it's offloading. Yeah. So it makes me wonder, are we going to step back into that same, I'm not going to say it's a trap. You know, are we going to hit that same stumbling block where all of a sudden we're going to hit hardware limitations on this offload equipment, and then have MikroTik lose performance? And no, so I know they're doing some really clever stuff, MikroTik is. So now they just recently changed the switching interface implementation, right? So you used to have this master port association. So if you had switching ASICs, you would just say, all right, this is the master port and everybody's a slave off that, and it would engage the switching ASICs. Well, they've done away with that. So when you add things to a bridge, if it's capable of hardware switching, it automatically does it, right? It's brilliant. I think that's really cool. It's just now we're going to have to start keeping track of, all right, MPLS implementation, we add it in there if it's capable of doing it in hardware. And I'm saying they haven't said they're going to do this, but I'm assuming this is, you know, in the works, maybe something like this, where if it's capable of doing it in hardware, it'll switch it off to the hardware. So then you have to keep track of, well, all right, well, how much can I actually put into the hardware? And, you know, if, and Andrew was talking about his equipment backup earlier, right? So say I've got a really expensive piece of gear that I can't necessarily afford to keep a spare of on the shelf right now, but I've got this other one. If that main one tanks and I put this other one in and it doesn't have hardware offload, am I dead in the water? You know what I mean? So it's, you're going to have to try and, I'm not saying this is problematic or troublesome or will be difficult in any way. It's just kind of stepping through it in my mind. It's sort of interesting that we have to go back and start looking at that. One of the guys in the Slack channel posted up a Cisco link that was really interesting, talking about different Cisco switch models and line cards and just the extreme oversubscription that they have in some of those things, you know. And so am I going to have to go back to trying to keep track of all that stuff and you know, keep really good telemetry on all of my network equipment and say, oh, well, it looks like I might be bumping up to that point where hardware offload is going to start choking. I need to swap this piece of gear out. That was a long diatribe. You guys have any thoughts on that?
Well, you kind of have to do that to a certain degree now with some of the hardware, which switch ports are connected to which CPUs.
Yeah,
I mean, you have to look at that on the 3011s. You know, the SFP is connected to, you know, the second CPU, which is, you know, you don't want, you know, the SFP connected to. We run into this a lot on backhauls. If you have, you know, a bunch of backhauls connected to the SFP and you have, you know, Ethernet 1 through 5 connected, you know, you're going to see a performance hit if you have other backhauls connected to certain Ethernet ports just because of CPU limitations. Simply moving a high usage backhaul to another Ethernet port can... Yeah. Can increase your performance just because of how the CPU is tied into the port. So you already have to do stuff like that in certain degrees. Point.
That's like the Gen 1 CCR1009. I think the first half of the ports had one single gig channel back in, and then the second half had a single. But now the new CCR 1009, the new version with the dual power supplies and everything, all the really cool features, each one has a 1 gig pipe back in. Yeah. So we had somebody in the Slack, I don't know, last week before say, hey, I've got the CCR 1009 and I only seem to be able to push this much traffic. And that's exactly what it was. They ran into that. So yeah, you're right. We already are dealing with that.
So I think, you know, I think as they increase, you know, more and more, you know, yeah, sure, they have 72 cores, but or 16 cores or whatever it happens to be. But as we increase more and more and we maybe become a chassis-based type of solution where we cram more and more ports into these things and we dedicate more and more ports or more and more cores per processor or more and more cores per port or whatever we have to do, we will have to keep track of this stuff.
Hmm. Yeah, I usually try and limit the number of physical pieces of equipment that I put in the network, or at least models, right? I like to try and kind of standardize. I think most people do that, right? So you get to know your equipment that you're using, and that way I just don't... I want to think about as few things as I possibly can, and that helps me do it in a very significant way.
That's how you sleep at night?
It's hard for me to turn my brain off. For years now, I put one earbud in and I turn on like a Twitch stream with somebody really low. So somebody that just mostly talks, and within about 8 minutes, I'll be out. Otherwise, my brain will just keep crunching and crunching and crunching.
Otherwise, yeah, so. You just go to bed with Christy.
We can't have that.
Sorry, Chris. That's true. Yeah, that's true.
I like to hear a man's beard rustling on his microphone in my ears while I'm going to sleep.
I have to have a TV on because I have to be engaged enough. Because if I just had like the one, you know, Twitch stream in my ear, that's not engaging enough for me. I would just ignore it, and you know, it's like, well, that's not interesting. Let's move to, you know, how am I gonna configure this or migrate that? But it can't be too interesting because then I'm focused on it. I can't go to sleep then. So I define a happy medium, and currently for me, that's watching Star Trek Next Generation reruns. I've seen them all, so I don't, like, I'm not, like, you know, stuck on it waiting to know what happens. I already know what happens.
Yeah, I know.
How does not keep your mate up while you're watching TV? How does that not keep her awake?
She used to watch TV as well. I think it was more along the lines of she wanted to watch something and then just fell asleep. She has no problems falling asleep. She, you know, I'll walk out of the room for 10 minutes, come back, and she'll be asleep on the couch.
Yeah, I was gonna say you guys are all weird. I just try and go to sleep and hope the cats don't attack my feet.
What sleep? I sleep about 2 hours at a time.
You're a monster, dude. You're an animal. I can't do that. I need like a good solid 8. I don't know how you young bucks do it.
Young buck. Isn't Justin older than you?
I think I'm the oldest here, aren't I?
Yeah, you are. But I look the oldest, so I can say that.
Yeah.
All right. So let's see. Something else I did this week is I put up a little YouTube video. I'm trying to be more engaged and trying to put out more stuff. And so I was just looking around at my network lab. I saw it sitting there because I was working on it. Whenever I'm doing, you know, the lynda.com stuff, oh, yeah, I'm supposed to promote that more. lynda.com/Greg Soule and LinkedIn Learning. You can find some of my CCMP courses on there. And I don't know how much Cisco stuff you guys use, but I put a bunch of interesting content out there. But it's not just that. You go on LinkedIn, you create an account, you get access to all of their content library. It's really great.
Otherwise, if you just really need to listen to something to help you get to sleep at night, you
just... Yeah. But anyway, all of the courses I build, I use Live Labs. And so I have my network stack over here and just did kind of a little video on it. And I basically have a whole bunch of routers run into a core switch. And then I use a console server. So I just tell that into, you know, 7001 is router 1, 7002 is router 2. That way I can just change VLANs on the core switch. So I don't actually physically cable. I don't move cables around. I just change VLANs on that core switch. So it makes it really quick and easy. That way when I'm building these Lynda labs, because I'm actually doing real live router configurations in these things. So whenever I move from one lab to the other, I don't want to have to walk in here and then recable all this crap. You know, I can just paste in my config change script and then it's the new labs ready to go. What do you guys do for your labs? Is just a whole bunch of stuff stacked up on your desk?
Yeah, mine's mine's a lot of stacked up stuff, GNS3 with some images. That way I don't break stuff. A lot of hands-on. I mean, a lot of stuff is repetition. A lot of it's the same old stuff. You know, configure VLANs, configure Q&Q tunnels, configure the same old stuff. I mean, most of the stuff I do that I have to learn is for certification tests, it seems. Then I don't do it for, you know, the longest time, and yeah, till the next test, or if I have to do it again, I Google it.
Yeah, luckily I had to recert just recently, so I did my CCMP switching. So I had just finished the CCMP switching course, and then I studied for 3 days, and then took the test. I was like, well, perfect timing. So that worked out well for me. But I feel like I've done the GNS, and I actually use it a couple of times in one of my courses just because there was some advanced features that I didn't have hardware that would support it. And I like it, but I know when I was first really learning networking, there was something, something that helped lock all that information in my mind. Something, you know, it's very visceral about completely uncabling all of your lab and then cabling it all together. Cause I learned, like, cause I would screw stuff up. And so it taught me to troubleshoot. What did I just screw up? You know, like I ran the cable the wrong place. Well, you know, it gave me strategies to figure this stuff out in a very quick manner. And I don't necessarily think you get that when you're using like Cisco's packet switch or GNS, you know?
And to me, it's easier to reset a physical device. There's something about it's easier to reset a physical device than to reset a device within GNS3, it seems. I don't know what it is about it, but it just seems, hey, I plug in my console cable, I, you know, reset the register, and it's easier. I mean, it doesn't seem like it should be, but...
Knowing you're resetting the right device as well. It's like,
true.
This is definitely the one. That's another trap you get into with virtualization. Like, am I logged into my test router or am I logged into my real router? And I had an instance of that the other day. One of the junior guys was going, oh, this has come back from a site that we upgraded the router at. I've just got to log into it and reset it. No, he logged into the live one.
No.
Unfortunately, like config backup, so it was back up within about 5 minutes. But yeah, it's having a physical box there you can push the reset on, and that testing quite often I've got stuff piled up on my desk, and I sort of clear it out every now and again when I'm finished doing something. It'll all go away, and I'll get a new stack there. But yeah, for me, I always like to have some physical devices there so I can actually plug things in and see how it all works. And
yeah,
that way, the virtualized environment also I can just have it connected to my machine, and I don't have to worry about breaking anything in the real world. It's like there is a physical level of separation there. I can just plug my laptop into it and test everything. So,
and you know, if the IP connectivity is, you know, is it the virtualization that's broken, or is it, you know, you don't have to wonder, is it the virtualization? You know, hey, if I can't ping across the two, I've screwed something up, or my cable's broken. And that's
it. There's other stuff too, like with Cisco's packet switcher. You know, it's like their manufactured lab, and you don't run into bugs the way you do when you're using real code, you know? And so I've run into those plenty of times in lab scenarios, and it's like, you need to know. That's one thing you can't learn in a book is to troubleshoot, right? It's something you have to be there. It has to break. You have to start sweating immediately and learn to figure that stuff out, right? And you're not going to do that with kind of a manufacturer's perfected lab environment. You got to, at least in GNS, you have real code you're running, right? So you have the opportunity to run into those bugs. I think also you can't simulate, you know, wireless links in GNS, right? So say in my stack, I've got Microticks and I've got Cisco switches, and say I want to test some kind of weird LACP through an EOIP tunnel doing, you know what I mean? It's like you can actually, with real hardware in an environment like this, you can set that up in 10 minutes and configure it where you're never going to be able to accomplish that sort of stuff in a virtualized environment.
The real question is, why are you trying to do that, you heathen?
Sometimes... That's what I. Oh.
Some men just want to watch the world burn.
You know, it's like if you're in immense pain, morphine is really great, right? But if you're just hanging out at the house, you probably shouldn't use it. So it's one of the, you know, that's kind of the curse and the blessing of MikroTik, is that you can do all kinds of stuff, and a lot of times you absolutely should not be doing it. And you can accomplish the same thing in so many different ways, and some of them can be. It works, but man, you really shouldn't be doing that. And I don't know.
Sometimes you'll find someone's configuration. You're like, why did you do this? Like, did you not know about this tool over here? And they're like, see their eyes light up, and it's like you've just given them like a bucket full of candy. Like,
or how about you hit a router that you configured 2 years ago, and you're like, Christ, what was I thinking? Yeah. I can't.
Who wrote this configuration? Oh, Andrew Cox. Yeah.
Looking at a router and you got a client on your phone and you're like, you're about ready to say, who the crap? Oh, I did this.
I have problems. So asked, where... Go ahead.
So you asked, you know, what our lab environment was like.
Yeah.
Have you seen the Bill O'Reilly We'll Do It Live rant? That's
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
I had about 5 750s one time that I built a lab with for about 6 months, and then I needed them for something, and that's been it.
Customers are watching right now.
It works. It works.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because you make darn sure you know what you're doing before you do it when you're doing it in production.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, do you though? I don't know. You can't, like we were talking about finding bugs earlier, you can't always account for that. So do it in a small, yeah, something people have learned before is when you're trying out a new feature, don't roll it out network wide. Try it in a little corner of your network, right? See how it does. Try it in the office first. Use yourself as a guinea pig. All right, so coming up pretty soon is WISC America in Birmingham. And Wilson, you said you may be going?
Yeah, it's not 100% confirmed, but I'm talking to the Cambium guys about doing some stuff with them now that I'm, you know, official Cambium person with them. So that's going to be the deciding factor if I'm going or not. So, yeah.
You know, I was at a summit, or as I don't know, it was kind of a networking event not too long ago, and I saw they had a Cambium booth there, and I was like, that is weird. I've never seen these guys. So apparently they have kind of their own UniFi killer out there. So they're doing access points that are supposed to compete directly with UniFi, and their controller is going to be CN Maestro. So it's just built right in there.
They're doing the CN Pilots and the CN Maestros, and or the CN Maestro for the controller. It's not as, you know, it's getting there for as far as functionality goes.
That was the comment that was most of what the conversation consisted of with me. They said that it's going to be a little bit more expensive than the UniFi stuff, but cheaper than like Ruckus gear. So it's interesting. And Cambium's got a good name out there in the market. So we'll see where that ends up. I think they also said that they have the CN Pilot that's the free version, and then pretty soon they're going to announce like a pro version that's a paid version. Does that sound right?
For the CN Maestro, for the software behind the scenes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's the plan. I mean, it'll be good because there'll be actual development behind it. I mean, they'll actually throw resources behind it, and there'll be, you know, very, very swift development for features and things like that, so... It'll, you know, it'll move pretty quickly for feature development.
That's cool. That's cool. All right. Next up is the MUM in Australia, and Foxy Coxy, you're going to be there, right?
Yep. Definitely going to be there. And, yeah, so myself and Thrift, as far as I'm aware. So anyone that wants to come hang out with us, have some beers, tell us what we're doing wrong.
Now you'll get a lot of people.
First you have every to talk time, about what you're doing, and then they can tell you how you're doing it. That's one thing I'm afraid of. I don't want to tell anybody what I'm doing so that Thomas can scream at me at how stupid I am. That's what I'm terrified. I just don't want Thomas to yell at me, I think is most of how I live my life these days.
Dad, no, Dad.
Oh, geez. All right. Well, I got nothing else. So, Andrew Cox, if people want to reach you on the internet, if you want them to reach you on the internet, how do they do that?
admin@microtik-radaros.com. Completely non-affiliated with the real Microtik.
Not to be confused with. Sweet. Justin Wilson, if people are going to reach you out on the internet, how do they do that?
j2sw.com.
Booyah. Mikey. How do people get a hold of you?
I'm busy, so don't.
He always says that, but he's desperate for your attention.
He's always on Facebook.
He's fishing. He's fishing for it. Yeah. So facebook.com/brotherswisp. That's pretty much Mike. All of that information, all of the good stuff that gets put up there is Mike. All of the quick interactions, that's Mike. So be sure to pop in and say hi and thank you for his great information.
Go ahead. Follow-up from the last cast.
What's that?
So last guy asked about USB-powered Microticks, and we talked about those for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought one, and I used one, and let me tell you that you should have an Ethernet cable on you when you're working on wireless configurations of a Microtik, because otherwise you spend the entire time, this didn't work, reset, now type everything back in again.
Oh, Mike.
You know, reconfigure everything exactly how it was before, and then try this other option. Because I was trying to do a single radio APN client. and I got it to work. It ended up not being until I was on the airplane that I got it to work, but...
Nice.
I'll probably dump... I'll probably actually plug it in then, you know, now that I'm at home and clean up the config, because it always had the default config in there, because if you wipe the default config, we have nothing to plug in with. It's not an AP anymore.
Got no wireless access.
So then I can't get into it. So I'll probably make a clean config and put that up on our, you know, Facebook or something for people that want to, you know, take their microticks and turn them into, you know, single radio repeaters.
Hey, that's how you play computer games together on airplanes. You've got to have a wireless access point.
Yeah, yeah.
Back in the day, we used to use a USB powered switch, but that only goes so far.
Yeah. I remember it was probably a year ago. I was on a flight and I saw they had one of the SSIDs for the crew was on there, and it was web encrypted. And I was thinking, wow, that's secure. I was thinking I've cracked so many web keys, but I think this is one I should probably not play around with. Just because a lot of times I'll do something just to see if I can do it, aka a flamethrower. But it's like, we'll just wave bye to this one and say maybe next time. Yeah. All right. So if you guys want to find me, Greg at gregsoul.com. You can also find gregsoul.com. I'm trying to put some more stuff out there. The more you guys hassle me about
not all networking related.
Yeah, no. The more likely it is that I'll put stuff out if you hassle me about it. I've been doing a lot more network design stuff lately, a lot more, so holler at me. Happy to help. A lot of BGP stuff. I'm actually doing a presentation on BGP. I think I've got an interesting angle that's going to be bigger than just Microtik related. So I think it'll be kind of a neat one that I haven't seen anybody do yet. So questions, comments, fire them off. Contact us at thebrotherswisp.com. If you're old school, if you're newer school or a soccer mom, hit us on facebook.com/thebrotherswisp. You can also find us on Patreon, patreon.com/thebrotherswisp. That way you can get access to the Slack channel. Great resource for all kinds of stuff. Man, I see Josh was talking about some hardware development, and we threw out some ideas there to help him with this piece or that piece. Really cool stuff. There was a guy looking for a relay for his air conditioning system. We helped him find that, right? So server-related questions, network-related questions, VoIP-related questions, man. It's a really good knowledge pool we're gaining in there. I love it.
It's probably not relationship advice.
No, I'm not qualified for that.
Server-client relationships, maybe, but... Oh,
Christ. There's Andrew. We missed you, Andrew. what was that haiku I found the other day? Winter is coming, but I hate orthodontists, so I'll brace myself. there you go. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening. Questions, comments, fire them your way, and we'll see you guys next time. Bye.
See ya.
Bye.